And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Mason Williams emerged in the late 1960s as a strong force in television and music circles. In 1968, he won two Grammy Awards with his unique composition for guitar, Classical Gas. That same year, he also won an Emmy Award for his work as a comedy writer on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Mason is perhaps most widely known as a composer and recording artist. He has recorded more than two dozen albums, five on the Warner Brothers label, the Mason Williams Phonograph Record, the Mason Williams Ear Show, Music, Handmade, and Share Pickers. Classical Gas was released as a single from the Mason Williams Phonograph Record in 1968. Classical Gas won three Grammys that year for Best Instrumental Theme Composition, Best Instrumental Theme Performance, and Best Instrumental Orchestra Arrangement, featuring Mike Post as arranger. In 1987, Mason teamed up with Mannheim's Steamroller of Fresh Air fame to release a new album on the American Gramophone label. The album, titled Classical Gas, includes a remake of his 1968 Grammy Award-winning song. Another cut from this album, Country Idol, was a 1988 nominee for a Grammy in the country music category for Best Instrumental Performance by Soloist, Group, or Orchestra. This album went gold in 1991 and is now approaching platinum. Mason has released On the Real Music label an acoustic instrumental album of Christmas holiday music titled A Gift of Song, featuring arrangements of traditional carols and original compositions. In 1992, the Vanguard label released Music, 1968 through 1971, a compilation of cuts from his five Warner Brothers albums recorded in the late 60s and early 70s. As a comedy writer, Mason has written for more than 150 hours of network television programming. Writing both music and comedy, Mason was a prime creative force for CBS' controversial Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. His extensive repertoire in folk music gave him the background for many of Tom and Dick's comedy routines with his co-writer Nancy Ames. He also composed the show's musical theme. He also created and perpetuated the 1968 Pat Paulson for President campaign, the most elaborate political satire in recent history. Other major television personalities he has written for, well, include Roger Miller, the great Petula Clark, Andy Williams, Glenn Campbell, Dinah Shore, and Steve Martin. 1980, Mason was head writer for NBC's Saturday Night Live. In 1988, Mason received his third Emmy nomination as a comedy writer for his work on the Smothers Brothers' 20th reunion special on CBS. He is also the creator of the world's largest sunflower. Originally intended as a short film, the sunflower concept was conceived as a slow-motion aerial ballet in which an old biplane, Sky Wright, draws the stem and leaves of a sunflower in the sky beneath the sun, thereby becoming the blossom of the flower. Approaching the 50th anniversary of Classical Gas gave Williams an opportunity to reflect on his career and collect many of his arts, writing, and music projects into a fantastic retrospective presentation that has been and continues to be exhibited in galleries around the world. Mason is also currently working on events around the celebration of the 50th anniversary of Classical Gas, including writing, composing, and performing in a variety of venues, which continues to this day. Please welcome musician, composer, songwriter, poet, TV comedy writer, photographer, the great Mason Williams of the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Mason.
Hi, Ray. Boy, that's quite the send-up. Thanks.
And that's just part of it.
Yeah. There's a lot of details in between.
There is a lot of details. You know, I wasn't as familiar as all your comedy writing background. I didn't know you did so much in the comedy field. I knew you were part of the Smothers Brothers, but I didn't know you wrote for other shows as well.
Yeah, you got a reputation, for being able to take on all kinds of stuff. And I would say my comedy writing began because I was a folk singer. Mm-hmm. And you basically had to have, comedy in your act, eventually, if you were going to be an act. And, that involved funny intros and funny songs. And so that's kind of really where it started. And it was a natural for me to go on and continue exploring this with the Smothers Brothers. And I had learned about 300 folk songs when I was in college as a folk singer, and that came in really handy as a resource for Tom and Dick. Because with Tom and Dick, were really good. Tom played guitar well, and Dick, covered the basic bass part,
right.
And they sang well, and Dick's voice was a little bit higher than Tom's, so that was great for harmony. And I must have had 20 or 30 of my own songs on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and Classical Gas was there, and we, Nancy Ames and I, wrote the theme for the da 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 da. That was the theme, and we never got to sing the lyric to the theme. The lyric was pretty short. It went like this: "It's the Smothers Brothers, a showbiz act with a sibling complex. They might as well be married. Lots of arguments and no sex."
I had no idea.
Well, the general public didn't either.
Yeah, that's so exclusive. It's like when we heard Dick Van Dyke sing the Dick Van Dyke theme, you know?
Oh, yeah.
No one's ever heard that either, yeah.
It's hard to... do you want to talk about my career, basically, and sort of chronological
order? We'll talk about everything. The part in the Smothers Brothers, where Tommy's always, Mom Loves You Best, did that come from you, or is that a creation of Tommy?
They came up with most of the material, and it was interesting writing for them. They said our act is not, we don't do jokes. It's called relationship comedy,
right.
And
right.
It's pretty much their arguments between each other, or basically Tom acting foolish when they're trying to do a song together. And there were a lot of examples of them starting, but once in a while they would do complete a whole song. And they did one album called Smothers Brothers Play It Straight, and they did a whole album of where they just really sang and played together.
That was a great show. That was one of the shows.
It started in it came on Tom and I were sharing an apartment together in LA and lived up above Sunset Boulevard, he was on the road a lot with the act, and I was basically living in the same apartment, and so I could kind of do things for him when he was on the road if he needed it. And it was during that time that we got the idea that we got the offer to do a show on CBS, and it was on Sunday night at 9:00. It was called the Kamikaze Time Slot because something like 9 shows had gone down against Bonanza. So
yeah,
they thought,
tough one. Yeah.
Yeah, the toughest. And so they decided to let Tom and Dick have a shot at it. And so Tommy and I kicked around a lot of ideas. And one of the things that was going on was that cable television had just started, and I think it was on Channel 5 in L.A.
Right.
This was in 1967, and it was only on in the evening, like from 7 to 11. But it had Mort Saul and, I can't think of the guy's name. Anyway, the guy that smoked the cigar all the time on the show. I'm at that point in my life where I have Alzheimer's disease. Sometimes I remember and sometimes I don't.
It wasn't Alan King, right?
How could I forget that? He was married to the singer, Edie.
Edie Gourmet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Steve Lawrence?
Huh?
Was it Steve Lawrence? Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet?
It wasn't Edie Gourmet.
Adams. Edie Adams, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't remember his guy. He was so great. And so anyway, I'll remember it as soon as we hang up, naturally. But anyway, we were watching these shows, and we thought they were a lot more interesting than what was on television.
Ernie Kovacs, was that it?
Ernie Kovacs.
Yeah, I remember Ernie Kovacs, yeah.
He was really great. And, that was one of the inspirations that we thought that some of these wackier and more politically oriented people were more interested in. I think one of the most, unusual aspects of my comedy writing career was when I was in college, I worked in a record shop. This was in Oklahoma City in 1958, 9, and 60, mostly 58 and 59. I worked in this record shop, and people would order these comedy albums that people I'd never heard of. As special orders, and of course, when one would show up, I would play it a couple times carefully, not to scratch it. And so I was aware of Lenny Bruce really early, and from the weirdest place in the world, Oklahoma City, to be involved with Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul, and also the Body, Oscar Brand, and.
Mm-hmm.
There were albums called Party Records, and a lot of them were black comedians. Red Fox was on it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Some guy named Dootsie Williams, but they would play these sort of dirty joke, funny comedy, bits at parties and whatnot, and I got to listen to them too. So by being in that record store, I was way ahead of the curve in terms of what was unacceptable in the mainstream, anyway.
The Smothers Brothers got a lot of flack for some of the things, the political stuff, and which today's standards would have been no big deal at all, A lot of people didn't know. Now, their dad actually died in World War II. Is that right?
Right.
He was actually
on a ship that the U.S. bombed. It was an American ship that got bombed by the U.S.
I didn't know that.
In a harbor, and I think it was in Tokyo.
Tokyo. Exactly right.
Right. He was a friendly fire victim, I guess you'd say.
As I read it, he was being transported from a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And
right.
I don't know, maybe the Americans, blew it up because he was... on that vessel or whatever.
I don't know that story as well. Yeah. And Tommy was real close to his mom and Dick, of course. And he had two sisters, and Sherry. His sister Sherry was the one that put me in touch with Tommy. And I used to play the troubadour, and I would sing all my goofy songs and songs and whatnot, and Tommy would ask Sherry, who worked at the Troubadour as a waitress, if to let him know if some of these weird comedy writers, funny songwriters came to the to the show and to let him know about him. And so Sherry said, well, there's this guy, Mason Williams, that has these offbeat songs and poems that he does, and he might be worth you checking out. So he invited me up to his house, and we spent a whole weekend, about 3 days, mm-hmm. Talking about material, and I played him lots of my material, and 5 days later, I made a record with him. I actually backed them up. I played guitar and banjo, five-string banjo, and recorder, and I became part of their act, and went on a tour with them in '65, all over the country, and I think I learned to write for them because when they were working out material, they would talk about it, you know, in the dressing room, and they'd say, well, you know, slow down when you say this, and don't step on my line, and
right.
All these sort of nuts and bolts of putting it together, and so I learned how to write for them by watching them talk about these things. And here's one of the interesting things that I'll say about Tommy was they would go to Las Vegas, and they would record, like, 10 shows, you know, because you were there twice a night for a week or so.
Right.
He would record 10 shows, and they would improvise during these 10 shows, and then we would go to a studio and take these quarter-inch tapes they were, mm-hmm. and basically go through the individual pieces from each night and edit together the best version of a piece. So, and then Tom and Dick would learn the piece off of the record.
Huh.
So they would experiment, you know, in live performance to come up
right.
with various ideas, but then they would take and sometimes it would be an oh yeah or an or just a smallest thing from one show, but it had the right inflection and the right timing, you might say.
Right.
So they would build these albums, and then they would memorize for performance mm-hmm. the way it was on the album, so it was really tight.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a remarkable approach to inventing their comedy bits.
Oh, it was, definitely. The show was wonderful. I mean, the music itself, you know, you would turn into Ed Sullivan, of course, but the other venue to hear, you know, what's happening in the music world, especially rock and roll, was definitely the Smothers Brothers show. You guys, I mean, from George Harrison, you know, Cream, Donovan, The Doors, Glenn Campbell.
All of it,
Oh,
what
God.
A thrill it was to work with all those people. And,
incredible.
Man, it was like six full hours over the 74 shows of music acts. And one of the things that we did was, an artist would come to the show, and we would say, well, you know, the general public wants to hear your hit, but why don't you also play the new thing that you've got? Or that you're most excited about.
Yeah, that's unusual. That's very
unusual.
Yeah.
We didn't just want the sort of the hit that was
mm-hmm.
and
good for you guys.
And here's what happened was that so many of these acts, we helped break so many new records for
mm-hmm.
you know, for the labels, that at one point Warner Brothers came to Tommy and said, you know, you've done so much to help promote our acts. Is there anything that we could do for you? And Tommy
right.
said, well, I think Mason would like to make an album.
There you go.
So that's how I got my album deal was from, you know, us presenting not only the classic hit of groups and individuals, but also their new thing they were most excited about. And so That's the way that happened.
Yeah, I talked to Jesse Colin Young, you know, of course, from the Youngbloods, and he walked off Johnny Carson because he just wanted to hear the hit, one hit, and he wanted to play something new.
Yeah.
So I commend you guys for doing that. That's wonderful.
We also, another aspect was, Tommy said, you know, if it's at all possible, we would like for you to actually play on the show and not just lip sync to a recording.
Right, right.
And that kind of depended on whether the shot had production values. You know, if you're doing wide shots and zoom ins and things like that, then sometimes you had to use the recording. But we thought that a show is more interesting if, for the audience, and that's who you want the reaction from, was more interesting if the group or individual were actually singing. Now, they could sing to a pre-recorded track, but we asked the bands, I said, if at all possible, we'll go to the trouble to set you up and let you play live, because that remember that whole thing with The Who?
Yes. I was going to ask you about that. during my generation.
Yeah, they were playing live, and the reason Peter Townsend lost his hearing, the story was, I don't know if this is out there or not, but they had put an explosive device in the drum for the rehearsal, and it didn't go off, and they put another explosive device in the rehearsal, in the next rehearsal, and it didn't go off, and then they put a third one in, and on the air, all three of them went off. That's what blew Keith Moon off of the back of the drums, and
he got hurt. He got hurt too, I think.
Yes, he did, and also Peter lost the hearing in one.
Where were you that night? Were you backstage or?
It depends. Sometimes you were, depending on the type of number it was, but generally the writers were in a suite with there's two or three television sets in there, so that you could so that you wasn't, you know, 10 people looking at one set. So there was like three of them, and sometimes you would see setups and stuff like that. And so I was probably in that room, but sometimes you were in the audience. You know, usually we sat way at the back because we didn't want to take up real audience space. And but generally, I think I was in that room during that time.
Yeah, I think the incident's on YouTube. I think I first saw it there. It's incredible, and it's also on the Who album.
Well, it was a big one for the Who, and well, they were an amazing group, and still are. You know, I mean, like I say, Jesus, we just had everybody you could think of on the show. And,
incredible, and like you said, a lot, because I noticed. I remember the Association played. And I think they were playing live. I could tell.
Yes, they were. Yeah. I wrote a really funny joke for the Association.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, they came on the air to sing Cherish, their big hit.
Right.
And Tommy comes out. He says, well, right now, ladies and gentlemen, we would like to feature the Association singing their hit Cherries.
Cherries.
And Dick goes, Tom, it's not Cherries, it's Cherish.
That
and
sounds
Tom
like him
goes,
too.
Cherish. Well, that changes everything.
I like that.
So anyway, and I wrote most of the music act intros and things like that, and especially all the folk and country ones, because I was really familiar with not just who they are, but their whole career in one sense. That was. Like when Roger Miller came on, I knew a lot about him. And,
oh, yeah. I like Roger Miller. Yeah.
And always had a feeling for how to make them come off well and, you know, what would be the right intro to set up the song and them as an artist. Tommy was also very gracious about letting new people come on the show and have a shot. You know, that's how Pat Paulson got on the show.
That's right.
And,
who was also a Marine, by the way.
Yeah, and Pat was really
great.
People
didn't know that.
He was fun to right for and perfect for television because he had that sort of sad face that
I know
resonated on television. And
I tell you one thing, you guys did a hell of a job promoting Pat Paulson because that's all you heard for a decade was Pat Paulson. He was everywhere, man.
that was the most extensive presidential satire that's ever been on the air.
You probably would have won today.
Boy, it would have been fun to be on television today. And people say, I get all kinds of comments from people saying, boy, I wish you guys were on television taking on the Trump administration.
Oh, man.
And I said, yeah, we would have, been right in the middle of all of that. And I still write political humor myself.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. One of the here's a short one, a little poem that I wrote.
Okay.
I had read this report about it. It said that 80% of the people didn't like negative political advertising.
Right.
Right. So
right.
Here's the poem.
Okay.
Mudslinging campaigns for political gains are slurs from the curs who conceive them. The truth come to pass is your head's up their ass as far as you'll believe them.
Like
those ads on the tube presume you're a boob who will fall for these half-baked lies.
Mm-hmm.
The truth evermore, since eons of yore, crocks of shit will always draw flies.
Yeah.
So anyway.
That's true.
100%. Yeah, and so in any words, but I mean, there's a reason. I have read a lot about the mechanisms of television, and one of the things is that it's only negative stuff that registers. Positive stuff doesn't.
Yeah,
resonate.
Shame, isn't it? It's a shame.
So. Yeah.
Television in the 60s was so good, you know, and we only had, what, four or five channels compared to 200 and some channels today, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, people say, the 1600s was the age of wonder, you know, that
mm-hmm.
the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And today it's... Let's see. Oh, I just had the word in my head again. It's the age of irony.
Of irony. Yeah.
And they said, well, how would you explain that? And I said, there's 500 television channels and nothing you want to watch.
Nothing you want to watch. It's true.
That's pretty ironic. And so
yeah.
The irony is that we have all of this social media and all these things going on, and yet we're not that satisfied.
No, we're not, and we're paying for it. We've never paid for television in the past. In the 60s, we just had to get an antenna. You know?
We're so the age of irony is
yeah,
upon us.
Yeah, too many commercials. That's another thing. You know, when I first got into radio, they
uh-huh.
told me no more than three commercials because you're going to lose
yeah.
your audience. And now look what's happened to radio, you know, with commercials. It's
yeah. Ridiculous. Well, you know, on the Smothers Brothers show, there was 54 minutes of content
mm-hmm.
and maybe a minute of station ID or something like that, but
right,
only six
right.
minutes of commercials.
That's amazing.
And now it must be, you know, in an hour there must be 12, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You lose your audience that way. Yeah.
Huh?
You lose your audience that way. You forget what you were watching, you know.
There are channels that I don't watch that I would like to watch because it's, there's just too many commercials.
Exactly. It's a shame. And,
and
there's good content, but then you just give up.
Yeah, CNN, you know, is interesting to turn into, but, man, it's just this
yeah.
endless barrage. And
shame.
So, you know, I I think that it's great that they're doing that well, but they're losing audience by virtue of the fact that the great thing about the human mind is that it it can keep track of, you know, gosh, once again, the longevity, I guess it is. In other words, the thing that allows you to read a novel is that you can keep track of the characters and the situations and all these relationships and whatnot. And so you're fragmenting the thing that people are really about, which is this ability for... No, the, that's right. The term is long-term memory. And so that's what allows you to, you know, follow a movie or follow a novel or all this kind of
stuff. Exactly right.
And I do remember reading a article about a guy who said that television is basically recreating the primitive mind. And he said that before this long-term memory began to really develop, people's thoughts were like this sort of jerky. They would go from one thing to the other and, and not particularly connected. And he said, one of the things you have to remember is that you are learning to think like the way you get your information.
True. That's true.
So if you're watching a lot of jerky stuff, you're a jerky thinker.
You know, people
unless of course you're reading books and just watching the films from top to bottom. So,
People are sick and tired of the politics on television. You know, enough is enough. Let's have some funny stuff. You know, let's see. You know, we want to go to television to escape.
I watch Saturday Night Live. I don't get it.
No, not like it used to be. And you were you actually got hired at Saturday Night Live, right? Back in what, 80 or something like that?
Yeah, I did. And I didn't work on. I couldn't take it. The old crew had just left, and it was a new crew. And weirdest thing about, I don't know if this is true of New York in general, but it seemed like that the people were more interested in having you fail than for the for you to succeed as a group, because it just seemed like everything was so competitive that
really?
You weren't really getting. And that was in L.A., man. It was a group effort. Everybody on the whole staff, you know, wanted to help you get your idea developed correctly and. You know, whatever you needed, they would help you find it. The research and all that stuff was in the typing. When I was on Saturday Night Live, I couldn't even get... I had to type all my own pieces. I couldn't get anybody to type them for me. But then they wouldn't accept my pieces because they weren't in quite the right form. So
Right.
It was just kind of a nightmare. I was only there about 3 months, and I said, I don't really, I'm not that interested in being a part of it. Eddie Murphy was on there. Let's see, Joe Piscopo. Charles Rocket, he was on there. And let's see, who's the guy, the great voice actor, you know, that did the Aflac, he's really a great voice actor. Once again, I'm dead.
It'll come to you.
Right, I'll think of him later.
Yeah, I grew up with, you know, Belushi and Chevy Chase and Lorraine Newman. I mean, that to me, that was Saturday Night Live. You know, every Saturday, just sitting around, you know.
Well, you see, the whole, that was one of the things that, they always say that the Smothers Brothers really paved the way for Saturday Night Live. The only thing wrong with the Smothers Brothers is that it was on at 9 o'clock on Sunday night, and so they decided that after all the, quote, church people go to bed, then then they're up for something a little wilder, looser. And so they just, Saturday Night Live, in one sense, was like putting something like the Smothers Brothers show on later at night.
Yeah.
And they... go ahead.
One of my favorite guys you were very instrumental, I understand, in helping with Steve Martin.
Well, I was good friends with Steve. We used to play the folk clubs there in L.A., the Troubadour and the Ice House.
He's a great banjo player. He really is.
He was playing well even back then, although back then he didn't he played it in his act, but he didn't really think about being a musician like he's doing now these days, touring with his Stone County.
With Edie Brickell. He plays with Edie Brickell now. He plays with Edie Brickell a lot.
Yeah. I saw them here in Portland. I saw their show, and it was really good. And he's got a new musical that's out there. But anyway, I had hired Steve because we'd played so many shows together. Mm-hmm. And Tommy just said, "Who would I like to hire?" And I said, "Well, there's this one guy that seems like he's really unique." And a lot of guys just string jokes together in their act, but Steve seemed to have a kind of a comedic philosophy that he was working on, and so I said, if I can hire somebody that I want to, it would be Steve Martin. So I was responsible for him getting his foot in that door, and I also talked Andy Williams into hiring Steve to write comedy on his variety show.
Oh, so. I used to love Andy Williams. I met him once at a Christmas show.
I wrote two of his specials, a Christmas one and then a one that had it was Andy and Ray Charles and Mama Cass and Burt Bacharach.
What a show.
God, those shows were great because they would bring together so many great stars and he recorded a couple of songs of mine, and I produced one side of an LP of one of his records.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the back side of Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. He was basically doing covers of hits and stuff like that. But
right.
he was really interested in trying new things, and I really loved working for him.
Yeah, he's very much missed, but we still get to hear him every Christmas.
People get to wear his sweaters, remember?
That's right. Yeah, the the Christmas sweater, right?
He was famous for those.
Mom one.
He was part of a musical family. All of his other four brothers were really great singers, and a couple of times they were on the show singing in harmony and whatnot, and they were really good. And he was a unique singer, boy, I have to say.
Yes, he
was. In the studio, you could just ask him to sing high notes, falsetto, whatever.
And beautiful voice.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
And very, really knew how to sell a song. That was a big part of it.
The only other guy that comes close to him that is still around today is like a Johnny Mathis, you know?
Johnny Mathis was I saw him perform live. I was playing with Tom and Dick and at the Fontainebleau in Florida.
Yeah, Miami. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was the opening act, and so I got to watch him, and of course we were crazy about All Chances Are and all those great songs that he'd done back when I was a teenager. He was an unbelievable voice on the radio.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the great things about Tom and working with Tom and Dick is you got to sort of hang out with all of these
legends.
And it's like being in school with them, you know. I remember writing a piece for Jack Benny, and Benny sat down with me for about 2 hours and took me through the piece and said, "Well, this is where you've got it right for me, and this is where it's not right for me, my character." And God, you just got this amazing education from working with all these people. And
how cool is that? Yeah,
yeah.
I get the same thrill when I'm interviewing, because I've interviewed people like Tutula Clark and Engelbert Humperdinck, and I did Rich Little.
Yeah. Well, I did Petula's special, too.
I saw that. I saw Petula. She is so awesome. And she still tours, you know.
She was an amazing one take singer. Boy, you know, she was so good that whatever it was, she did her homework, and it was like, okay, one take, that's it. Unless there was a technical thing wrong with it, but she never made a mistake and never was out of key or anything like that. And yeah, I was at Harry Belafonte, and was her and
I remember that. Remember that controversy?
I was in the booth when that took place.
You were in the booth, huh?
Yeah, and
so ridiculous.
Yeah, it was bizarre. We were sitting there, and they're walking. They were singing a little song that I wrote, which went like this: "Isn't life beautiful? Isn't life gay? Isn't life the perfect thing to pass the time away?" They held hands, and the sponsor in the booth said, "Wait a second, they can't do that." I remember it clear as a bell. And then
what year was that? Do you remember? Was that like late 60s or what?
68.
See, that doesn't make sense, because a lot of things were happening in 68 that were convoluted, you know?
I guess it was...
I'm surprised.
I don't know who this guy... I don't remember who he was, but he might have been one of the sponsors.
Uh-huh.
You know, one of the reps for the sponsors. I can't remember who it was, but...
Yeah, he must have been a real square.
it blew up, and it was kind of a watershed moment for some of that kind of stuff. But Harry was was really great about fighting for... and he loved the Smothers Brothers show, because... that piece that we did about the National Democratic Convention that was censored.
Right.
He was part of that. And, I said, well, you know, we used to say to people, we'd say, well, come on the show and do something that is, career-oriented, their latest song or whatever, but if you've got something to say a commentary, let's talk about doing that as well.
Sure, why not?
So, and certain, I would say he was the most progressive individual that came out. He and Pete Seeger. There were others, too. I'd have to think back, but those are the two that come to mind.
Those were rough times. 1968 scared the crap out of me, because that's when all the assassinations happened, the riots. You know, my dad had a store in D.C., and he had it in 68. And, when Martin Luther King got shot, it was total turmoil, you know. It was a crazy year.
Here's a story nobody knows about. Robert Kennedy was going to come on the Smothers Brothers show and do an anti-smoking bit. And Tommy asked me to write, back in those days you'd write 50 things, thinking that, well, we're going to end up maybe looking at 10 of them, but so he tended to overwrite. And he was going to come on the show the week that he was assassinated.
Really? I did not know that.
And so, boy, it was hard to be funny that couple of weeks after that.
Definitely.
And because everybody on the whole show was sort of oriented toward what he was trying to do, and I'd have to look at... like I say, my theory was you write a whole bunch of stuff and you let the person decide what interests them,
and you
develop that. Here's the funny joke that would never have made it on the air, but let's see, Tom is talking to Bobby, and Tommy says, you know, Bobby, I wonder what would happen if Sir Walter Raleigh had taken marijuana back to England in 1765 instead of tobacco. And Bobby goes, well, I don't know, the Beatles would have been about 1850. that's a style of humor called what if, you know.
Yeah, what if.
What if. And that was the great thing about writing all those television shows.
I'm surprised they didn't ask you to do Laugh-In.
because what if is a great comedy form.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about another legend here, which is Mason Williams. My first radio gig was actually in Sebring, Florida, right in the middle of the state here, and I used to sign my show off every night.
Mm-hmm.
Close the station down with, guess what? Classical gas.
Well, that was a big feather in my cap. Thanks.
Every night, that was part of my show because I love that song. And I can't believe you're coming up on 50th anniversary in 2018. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah, it was a hit in August of... I had written it the year before in 67
right.
And recorded it sort of in 67 in the fall. And then it became a hit sort of in February of 68. And it back in those days... songs would bubble under. Remember how they used to call that?
Yes.
And it bubbled under for about 6 months and finally mm-hmm. was a hit in August of 68.
Wow. And, originally named Classical Gasoline, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I started writing songs probably in 1960, and I think my first songs were sort of folk song-like because mm-hmm. that's what I knew. I had a teacher that used to say, if you want to learn to write something, learn 500 of whatever it is you're interested in, and you'll just know automatically how to write it. So
true.
It was natural for me to write sort of folk-like songs to begin with. And then it moved into, because of my act, it moved into comedy, novelty songs they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And he had funny songs and whatnot.
Oh, they were big back then, in novelty songs, too.
I wrote my first instrumental called $13 Stella in 1963, and I just began to... I was interested in classical guitar, but I was mm-hmm. also interested in pop music of the time, and so I think of Classical Gas really is a pop classical hybrid sort of a mix between
exactly.
the two.
Yeah.
And
classic pop. Classical
if I hadn't
pop. Yeah.
Everything I learned in music school, I sort of put into that song.
Mm-hmm.
I did, you know, in music school you're analyzing you're taking counterpoint and harmony and studying the classical structures and so I used several composition elements in that tune. Classical music has an intro, and then it goes into tempo and develops, and it sometimes it starts with a smaller group, and then the same theme is played again, adding more musicians, just to make it richer. And
sure.
then I put this whole thing of the circle of fifths in it when it goes up to the what I guess you'd call the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then at one point I used a thing called pedal point, which was where there was a whole section where it was all over an A note, so it was an A minor, but it was a pedal point was the A note.
Right.
And then I knew that the relative major of A minor was C major, so there's a little section in C major. And I also used a thing called, there's a thing in music where you can... take a phrase and you can make it the same notes, but you can make them shorter. So you could go dum ya da 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 dum da 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 da, something like that. But you go yum da 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 dum. In other words, it's the same phrase, but the note values are either half or doubled.
Right.
That wasn't a very good example of it musically, but. Anyway, that's how part of it, you know, it goes da 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 da. It's in triplets. Then it goes da 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 da. Those are all the same notes, but they're eighth notes instead of triplets. And at the end of the piece, I had learned this whole thing called it was in classical music was called tierce de Picardy. What that meant was that I didn't know it had religious implications, but I just recently learned that's true, that that they thought that the A major chord was the perfect chord. It was the Son, the Father, and the Holy Ghost. And
really?
Somehow in religious music, yeah.
Hey, that's why it got so popular.
I guess
so. Get God on your side.
But the Tierce to Picardy was... So that's why I ended classical gas with an A major chord, because back in those days, when someone would write a piece in A minor, there was a tendency to end the whole piece with an A major. So... here I was copying all these things I was learning in music school, and I think that those are what made it work as a composition. And that's the advantage of going to music school, is that you learn what all the greats were using to write their pieces, and they tended to coalesce around the best forms. You know, the Sonata Allegro. I knew about that when I was writing classical gas, and so whether you end up using them or not, you're aware of all these compositional techniques.
How long did it take you to write it?
I would say about two months,
right?
Something like that. And I wrote it when I was writing comedy on the Smothers Brothers show, because you'd burn out on some comedy bit, and I'd pick up the guitar and work out a phrase or not, you know, some part of it. So you were kind of using it to, refresh your mind or your thinking process, just to, because you have to leave comedy alone. It's like a painting; you got to come back to it after you looked at it. So I was actually written in between all those comedy bits for people, and because I took my guitar to work and. And I also used the guitar to work up comedy bits for Tom and Dick, but once in a while I would pick it up and work on classical gas, or Barocca Nova was another tune from that time. And so anyway, it was
you
this
did
whole
Green
idea.
Sleeves too. You did, that was
yeah, cool. And yeah. Green Sleeves was a hit, you know, an easy listening hit for me.
Sure.
And so I would say that. You know, well, you're kind of the sum total of all of your artistic endeavors, you know. So if you've studied music and art and whatever else, you know, math, all of that ends up being part of what you do. And another aspect is that you tend to imitate people you like, and they become sort of part of the fabric of who you are. And that's another aspect of it, is to, I get people every day, guitarists saying, well, you know, classical gas was the one that got me started playing a finger style guitar, classical guitar, and I think that classical gas survives because it's about the guitar. It's not so much about me.
Right.
It's not a celebrity type lyric or anything like that. So it's the way that I explore the guitar that makes it interesting. And I think I tell people, I think classical gas is a lot more famous than I am.
the song reached the all-time number one instrumental composition for BMI's repertoire.
That's right.
Number one.
Well, it was, like you say, it was on radio shows, it was on news shows.
Everywhere.
Been involved in some movies. And, never really hooked up with a commercial entity of any way. So it's been used a little bit in regional commercials, but, never a major commercial use of it.
Well, I've seen a lot of covers done, and I can tell you, nobody's done it as good as you, number one. But the only guy that's been kind of close is Glenn Campbell's version. I like Glenn Campbell's version.
Glenn was such a great player, boy, and
he
put his own little flourishes in it here and there,
because
he was really, but he stayed true to the composition. I think Tommy Emmanuel has a great version of it, and... I've got about 300 different versions of it.
Wow.
And like I say, I'm in touch with the, God, I did three people yesterday that were talking about classical gas as being inspiring to them, and I listen to what people, you know, I listen to people play, and I say, I tend to say, well, you know, you've got the composition right, and there's a few little places where you've made it your own, and that's what you always want to do, is whatever you do, you want to make it your own, and as well as what it is. So that's what Tommy Emmanuel did, you know, he's got these little... Mm-hmm. Little flourishes in it, I guess you would say.
Yeah, I like the original version though. I like your, you know, stay true to it.
Well, see, I really worked hard on making it a classical composition. It was 6 minutes long when I first wrote it.
Right, right.
And I said, well, you're never going to get 6 minutes played on the radio, and they're not even going to play an instrumental because, you know, it was all about songs pretty much.
Yeah.
But I just have, there was a DJ in, I can't remember, his name was Green, but it might have been in New Orleans, or it might have been in Denver, but anyway,
right.
He played the tune every hour for 24 hours, and just got everybody hooked on it, and some other DJ picked it up, and so it was back in the days when DJs, called their own shots, you know. I don't know that that's true anymore. It seems like
it's not even close. Unless you're on, you know, you got your own show on, you know, like satellite radio, or blog radio. They can do their own shots, but not on.
Yeah, John McEwen.
John McEwen. Yeah.
Yeah, he plays stuff I send him, and that's sort of, you know, not. It was kind of a shame when the individual wasn't in charge of what they played, that it became this sort of corporate entity about who's touring and who's got to deal with them, and you know, all these. But I mean, that's the nature of business anyway. It tends to move toward a system that is more about
money.
Money rather than, but I was lucky to be part. I don't think there would ever be an instrumental hit anymore. I mean, I doubt it.
You know, a lot of artists are doing like covers and doing instrumental albums nowadays too.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I talked to Dave Edmonds, you know, famous guitar player Dave Edmonds. He did an instrumental,
right?
And I just talked to a couple other guys that did instrumentals recently.
Classical
Gas might have been on one of them. Might have been a track on one of them, I think.
I always did a lot of research on, especially when I was writing for the Smothers Brothers, but in my own music, and I went back to the 50s and looked at the hit parade chart back then. There were a lot of instrumental hits back then.
Yeah.
You know, there was... remember that guy, Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White, and Mr. Sandman, and God, I mean,
good stuff.
You know, Nelson Riddle had he was the our music director on the Smothers Brothers show, but he had two or three hits back then, and I remember that about 20 or 30% of the hits were instrumentals back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And that that sort of ended. I was kind of on the tail end of that, so I was lucky to be part of. There were a lot of instrumental hits. Love is Blue and Grazing in the Grass, and there were all kinds of instrumental hits in the late 60s and maybe early 70s, but it kind of petered out after.
Yeah. Of course, we all love the Ventures. They were great.
You know, I was good friends with Noki Edwards.
With Noki. I saw you on YouTube with Noki. You guys were playing together.
Yeah. Yeah, he, what a gifted player.
Yeah, yeah. I know
Don. He was something.
Don Wilson. I did an interview with Don. He's a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love him.
Well, he lived here. I live in Eugene, Oregon, and he was living here for a while.
Okay.
And that's how we got together. And he was really something.
You know, Dick Smothers has a house here. I'm in Sarasota.
That's right. You know,
yeah.
I know a few. Well, you know, John McEwen lives in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Carlton, do you know him?
What part of Florida does he live?
Let's see. He lives in Mount Dora.
Oh, Mount Dora. Yeah, I know where that is.
Yeah, I think Jim Stafford might have a place in.
Yep, I like Jim. Jim's a good guy.
Yeah, I think he might have a place there. And Dick has a place there, and his their sister Sherry, I think, was living together.
Yeah, he's happy. He's happy here. I always see him on the news and local paper and things like that.
Right, and
I know he went through a little rough spell with, you know.
A little what?
A little rough spell, personal stuff, I think he went through.
He had a drinking problem, and I don't know if he was doing cocaine and all that. I thought cocaine was a bunch of crap for for me as a singer. I just thought it was really dumb, you know. I probably did it 10 times in my life, and I said, forget this. I was good friends with Ken Kesey, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I never took acid. That was kind of a...
That was the thing in the 60s, for sure, was acid.
Yeah, I missed that one. But Ken Kesey used to say, you know, he thought cocaine and all these sort of recreational things were not as interesting as really getting out there and being more like an astronaut mentally as opposed to...
Right.
And he's kind of demonized as a, you know, sort of, for his, you know, because he was part of that... drug-fueled San Francisco scene there for a while. But
how about good old Timothy Leary?
I knew Timothy and had dinner with him once in L.A., and I was on a show I was on once, a Dinah Shore show that I...
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I read all those books, Ram Dass and...
Right.
And
yeah, he's a smart guy, very intelligent guy.
Yeah, and Maharishi and all the...
Yep.
There was a lot of interest in all of those things back in the late 60s. And Tommy and I, Smothers and I, went to see Alan Watts talk a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
He was really interesting. And, I would try to write comedy bits about this. Let's see. One I wrote for Tom, I remember, was... extrasensory perception, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Tom and Dick are on stage, on stage, and Tom says to Dick, well, I've got, they were talking about extrasensory perception, and Tom says, I've got LSD. And Dick says, It's not LSD, it's ESP. And he goes, I knew you were going to say that. I knew ahead of time you were going to say
that. I miss those kind of jokes.
So,
who I saw last night? Arsenio Hall. He was here in Sarasota.
Oh, yeah. And
he was very funny. He didn't do anything political, which was smart.
Yeah.
He joked a lot about O.J. because, you know, he's out and he's in trouble already and he's thinking about moving to Florida and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But, he was good. He was, you know, you can tell he was the professional, you know.
He
cursed a little, but it was all right. He said he doesn't trust anybody that doesn't curse. You know?
Yeah. Well, that was an interesting aspect. There was a period, you know, in terms of people performing, whereas that if you were willing to swear, you were honest.
Right, you were honest, yeah.
I believe that was... And, in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a whole group of comedians that don't do that anymore. In other words, they don't rely on swearing as part of their you know, part of their act. Of course, you know, George Clooney was going to make a movie about the Smothers Brothers comedy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he thought their censorship battle was really an interesting thing. And here's a joke that a pretty good joke that I had for Tom. Mm-hmm. And when we were talking about this, and I said, Tommy, who do you think should play you in the movie? And he said, I don't know. And I said, I think it should be Scarlett Johansson. Scarlett Johansson. Why Scarlett Johansson? Just say, think how exciting it's going to be for us and you, and particularly when they tell you to go fuck yourself.
That's a good one.
So,
that's funny.
Well, there's always, you know, the funny jokes were, the funniest ones never made it on the air.
Never made it on the air, that's right. It should be a whole new show just for those jokes, you know, put on table.
Yeah. The jokes that got left out.
That got left out, yeah. You should do that. You'd be great today.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, in one sense, I was head writer for this show, and I used to tell all the other writers, I would say, don't censor yourself. You know, don't start writing with censorship as part of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Let them take it out, but you go
let
ahead
them
and
take
write
it out,
the whole,
right.
You write the whole thing the way you see it, and
and
let them butcher it if necessary, but don't shortchange your writing ability. Speaking of the word shortchange, here's one thing I'd like to get across in the interview is I don't have much of a career as a recording artist anymore because of the whole Napster element that wiped me out. And so, you know, one of the things that I thought was great about musicians is they were always willing to not only contribute money, but time toward cultural events and community events in particular.
Right.
And when I was making money, I did a whole series of shows that were for river conservation. I played 60 shows that were dedicated to
all that. Yep.
To saving, you know, for, you know, conservation campaigns. And I did a local Christmas show, and that was to sort of, you know, make heroes out of local artists. And I used to pay for all of this with money I made from the music business. And once the whole Napster, I guess, I don't know what you call it, but that, once that whole thing started, I wasn't making the kind of money I used to. And,
nobody was.
So not only did that shortchange the musicians, but that shortchanged the communities that all of these musicians were part of.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you didn't have the money to
to
contribute to local events. And I played 30 local Christmas shows, and it was to highlight the fact that, you know, there's talented people in every community.
Mm-hmm.
And
and
we always had, you know, children's choirs and whatnot, and they it was great for them because they got to see some really great professional musicians and good sound and production values, and so it was really educational for them. I have kids walk up to me now that are, they look like they're 30 years old, but they said, hey, I remember you, and I was in your Christmas choir back in 1992.
Right, That's pretty cool.
And so anyway, I think it's sad that the music business pulled the rug out from under not only musicians, but for the communities that they were part of and how they participated.
I talked to Derek Sutton, who managed a lot of big bands, Styx, and this, and he says the music business, it's run by people that don't give a damn about music, you know, basically.
Yeah, it's all numbers.
There's no heart there. You know, that's why I love.
Well, that was the whole thing. See, but you're talking about DJs. You know, it used to be. This is what I have feelings about, and I'm going to play it.
That's right.
And but now you're told what to play, and and.
Well, it's all on tape now too. The DJ doesn't have any say so. It's just.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah.
It's a shame. Well, congratulations. Congratulations, by the way, on being inducted into the Oregon Music Hall of Fame.
Yeah, Oregon and Oklahoma.
You did a show with Everclear and Paul Revere and the Raiders.
That's right.
In Oregon, right?
And John Doan, who's a harp guitarist, and I were part of that show. And
oh, cool.
And, well, Oregon's pretty hip. I would say that Portland and Seattle have generated some really interesting music acts.
Well, Seattle, for sure. That's Jimi Hendrix.
And
the grunge scene, yeah.
Right. The in one sense, if you want to make it in the biz, you used to go to Hollywood or L.A. or New York. But now, because of the way the internet and the way everything's done, you can sort of make it happen from anywhere.
That's right.
A girl that worked for me as my assistant here at my office is now in a Broadway show in New York City, a Christmas show.
Really?
Yeah. But she was able to build a whole career. Evan Hollins is her name. She's really a great singer and beautiful and dedicated to her community as well. She does a lot of children's shows.
That's awesome.
And I would say, and she became a star on YouTube, her and her husband, Peter Hollins. And so in one sense, you can make a career from anywhere now.
True.
I suppose if you still want to go to the right place to record things because the musicians are there and the equipment.
Right.
A lot of times you can't get the equipment that you need. It's out in the hinterlands, but
right.
They always have everything. That was the great thing about television, man. Anything you wanted was right there. The Smothers Brothers were thinking about having their show emanate from San Francisco at one point, but they finally said, you know, you just don't have the costumes, you don't have the elements that a show requires because you need it now and need it overnight. You can't wait 48 hours to get something that you need for a comedy bit because it's all right here in town. So that's why New York and Oklahoma and L.A. will always be the center of things because they have.
And Nashville's pretty big too. Great musicians in Nashville. Good hub.
You know, I was talking to a friend of mine, John Hadley's his name, a really great songwriter. And I was in Nashville in 1960 when it was, when they had the Songwriters Row there. And John said, all that's all gone now, it's just all these places that you sort of don't recognize. Because I remember, you went down the row and you'd go into these houses and people would play you these reel-to-reel tapes of songs and things. And so I made a record with Mercury, a folk album called Songs of the Blue and the Gray. But we got to go down Music Row, go into all these little houses and talk to these songwriters. And more personalized. It was kind of fun because, they were interested in you're always interested in the last thing you've written because you always think it's the best.
Yeah. It's true. Basically, we're kind of short of time here, but I just want to mention a couple of things.
Sure.
It's Christmas time, so everybody needs to go out and buy your A Gift of Song album, which is
that thing hangs up.
Rave reviews, by the way.
Yeah, it really holds up. And
traditional carols and original compositions for Christmas, and it's an excellent, excellent album. And,
It was six classics and eight by either me or my friends and I, because, I said, everybody writes a Christmas song, and so I tapped Rick Kuna and Art Maddox, who works with me, and Doug Haywood, who's a bass player and a great singer. So So I said, I just told people, I said, you know, you guys all have written a Christmas song, so let's coalesce them and put them on this album. And so it was great to, it's always great to arrange classics, and that's what I liked about my Christmas shows, is that I got to work on, arranging, the Christmas song or whatever it was, Joy to the World, you name it, it was like, and we always had sing-alongs on it, Jingle Bell Rock, and I would write comedy pieces. I wrote one called The First Motel. And and that's out there on CD, baby, if anybody
is it.
Great
album. Everyone needs to buy that for Christmas. We're gonna promote that on all my sites for you for
the I think that instrumental was good, because basically you could just put it on and it became sort of background, and it was the right kind of thing to play when you're decorating the Christmas tree, because it's not competing with talking. And so
that's right.
And I love to read the research on all the Christmas songs, and the Oxford Book of Carols I read. Boy, a complicated history. And the Christmas carols were originally dances, kind of like square dances, and then they eventually became songs that people sang. And the reason they came from the fact that the general public couldn't really participate in the church services, so they made up their own songs to sing at home and whatnot. And that's where, they borrowed melodies from anywhere. That's why, What Child Is This is the melody of Greensleeves, and nobody was worried about where anything came from back then. That's
right. I wanted to mention too that you had your friend. Is it Rushka? Edward Rushka? Is that how you spell?
Ed Ruscha.
Ed Ruscha.
Yeah.
Who you've known for a long, long time. There's a story here when you put the album together. I guess Vanguard put an album together of music of '68 through '71, a compilation of cuts from five Warner Brother albums for you, and they ended up throwing away a painting of his.
Oh, yes.
Would have cost $3 to $5 million. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I mean, Ed, he's probably the most famous artist in America. And I always say, Ed, you're the most famous artist in America that nobody's ever heard of. But one of his paintings just sold for $30
million.
Wow. So he's in the big time. And we grew up together in Oklahoma City. And he was struggling a little bit back in the early 60s, and anytime I had him do some storyboards for the Roger Miller show, I found that they're not interested in storyboards, but I thought it was a visual medium when I try. And he did this album, and we did a print together, and his best-selling print, as a matter of fact, his lithograph. And they're worth about $250,000 a piece.
Jeez.
I wish I'd have hung on to the five he gave me.
Oh, no.
But I gave them to friends. I gave one to my daughter.
Really? Oh, my gosh. I guess who would know,
Right. I sold one for $60.
$60? That figures,
Well, $60 was a lot of money back then.
I know.
Anyway, and... Oh, yeah, Ed and I are in this new movie that's out. You might want to check this out, called California Typewriter.
California Typewriter.
Yeah, and it's a documentary. It's about the history of the typewriter, and Tom Hanks is in it.
Tom Hanks, I know. I just read an article about him. He's really into typewriters.
Yeah, and he's in it, and John Mayer is in it.
Yeah.
And David McCullough, Sam Shepard, unfortunately... just passed away. He's in it, and it's about collectors and artists, and it starts with this book that Ed and Ruscha and I did called Royal Road Test.
How about that?
And so I never thought I would be in a movie, but here I'm suddenly in a movie with Tom Hanks.
Where can we see the movie? I mean, is it?
I I guess you can go to some website called this California Typewriter. Where is it playing?
Right.
I don't really know, but I'm, you know, I saw this one thing for September. Man, it was all over the entire country, and I assume it still is. We had a screening in L.A. at the Directors Guild, and for about 150 people, and gosh, I got to see all my old friends from L.A., and I'm linked up with Weird Al Yankovic here in the last
fall people,
year.
Yeah.
Boy, he is an interesting guy and really a gifted musician and satirist, and having a great time talking to him. And so I got to see Carl Gottlieb was a writer on the Smothers Brothers show. He was there.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And my friends from Oklahoma City, Joe Good, an artist, and Jerry McMillan, a photographer. And so that screening just brought people out of the woodwork, and it was so great to see they're all still engaged and doing things.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that movie.
It's really done well.
Yeah.
And I think it was done by a guy named Doug Nickel, who apparently did a lot of music videos. I'm not sure what they were, but he really did a great job of putting this together. And you'll be amazed at the history of the typewriter and the fact that it's still the way a lot of people really want to function, because you do end up with this tangible document.
Yeah.
And the digital world, the internet, is sort of this... maybe it still exists, maybe it doesn't.
Yeah, I hated carbon paper, though.
Oh, yeah, I was in the Navy in 1961, and God, and carbon paper, if you made a mistake, you had to start over.
It was terrible. Yeah, you know, my dad, so we had a retail electronics and gift store since the late 50s, my dad, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and he sold typewriters. And I remember the very early typewriters, because I had to bring one home for school or whatever. And then, of course, the electric typewriter came.
Man, wasn't that a great thing when you had correction tape on it?
Oh, my gosh. God. That was so awesome. But we're spoiled.
They didn't even have whiteout to begin with, you know.
No. Whiteout was a big thing. That was created by, was it Michael Nesmith from the Monkees?
That was his mom.
Yeah.
His mother invented that, and he's a good friend of Ed's.
Uh-huh.
And, there's Ed's so famous that he's in touch with all kinds of people in all realms of the arts and show business to a certain degree.
Well, Mason, you know, I could talk to you forever, man. I mean, you're a lot of fun to talk with. So what are your plans for 2018 with the 50th anniversary? Do you have any plans yet?
I don't know exactly what will transpire. Something will, of course. I don't play guitar very much anymore, and I had a physical problem called Dupuytren's contracture. As you get older, your hands sort of starts to curl up.
Right.
Maybe you've seen that, and I had it, and... I did have surgery. It's called enzyme surgery, so the hand wasn't cut open, but my palm was injected with this stuff, and it pulled all these adhesions loose from the...
Right. I'm going through something similar, so I understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, so in other words, what happens is the tendon... sheath gets attached to the palmar fascia, after the words, right? And but even after the surgery, my hand is not so curved up, but I've lost a whole fret in terms of stretch.
Really?
Yeah, I wish it would have been the other hand. That wouldn't have mattered.
I know. Are you going through physical therapy? Have you been doing that for a while?
No, there's nothing you can do. It's just
really
the way the cookie crumbles, as they used to say.
I broke my wrist in an accident, and I had several surgeries, and I got a plate and everything. And, of course, it's my right hand, my good hand. I've been going through therapy, and I'm just had these stellate ganglion block shots in my neck. That's supposed to help with it, and I'm going through a series of those.
Oh boy, that's
I understand what you're going through. It's not fun.
I haven't played for about 2 years,
because
I couldn't reach certain chords anymore, and so. But I started picking it back up again since the 50th is coming up. I got to be able to sort of get through it. If there's one place where I can't really reach a certain chord anymore.
Oh man!
So I'll just have to be funny at that point.
That's tough. I know.
Or something.
That's tough to have your 50th and you can't reach that one. Chord, you know.
But you know, physical
and
impairments.
It just doesn't sound the same on electric either.
No, and anyway, I'm hoping that I will be able to negotiate it enough to play it somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah, Mason, thank you so much, man, for being on the show today.
We really enjoyed
music
it.
And comedy. You've given us through the years. Congratulations again on 50 years of Classical Gas, one of my all-time favorite songs.
Still hanging in there.
It's really about
the guitar, and I was lucky to be part of a time when instrumentals were still on the radio.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know that, and the other song I always remember from the '60s. See, now it's my turn to lose it.
That's all right.
MacArthur Park was also one. MacArthur Park. Remember
oh
that
yeah,
song?
Yeah.
Because that came around the same time, and that was another one that kept building and building. You know, like Classical Gas.
Yeah,
you always remember that one.
I played a show with him in Oklahoma in 2013 when I was inducted into the Oklahoma Music Hall of Fame.
Yep.
And it was some country artists and whatnot, mm-hmm. but he and I were together at the same event. And I think he works for ASCAP now.
I'm mm-hmm.
So he's a big deal in the music business
basically a songwriter, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got to hang out with him a little bit. And I had written a TV show for the 10th anniversary of Rolling Stone magazine, and I was writing the show, and they asked me if I wanted to write the music for it. I said, no, I think he would be a better composer, and so he actually wrote the music for that theme. And I see on television that there's a documentary of some kind of Rolling Stone on TV right now.
I think the head of Rolling Stone is giving it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's giving it up to his son, I guess.
Jan Werner, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And it just doesn't have, you know, Rolling Stone went down for many years. It's kind of like Saturday Night Live. It's just, you know, not the same mm-hmm. anymore.
Well, I wrote a great idea for him and never got done. It was called The
Really?
Beatles Conspiracy. And it was the idea that the Beatles were actually a product of the British government. And because the British government has said, you know, we don't really have our colonies anymore, and we don't have a landmass where we can grow a lot of wheat like the U.S. But one of the things that the U.S. is good at is creating phenomenal of music talent like Elvis Presley and all kinds of music acts, but Elvis in particular. And so they decided, let's create a group of young men that are fashion icons and music icons, and let England move into the world of pop culture. And I had done all this research on the Beatles and whatnot, and the simplest thing was, in England, you only had to sell 60,000 units to have a top record.
Hmm.
So the government went out and bought 60,000 copies of I Want to Hold Your Hand. Easy.
That's why there's a lot of number ones in England, I guess.
Yeah. But anyway, it was a whole... It was a whole satire. I mean, it was a whole thing based on, it was a guy with a bunch of memorabilia goes to Rolling Stone and presents all this stuff and talks about the Beatles' career and how what you think it's all about isn't what it's all about at all.
Right. Imagine the Beatles playing MacArthur Park. I mean, classical gas. I had MacArthur Park on my mind.
Right. Well,
that songwriter is Jimmy Webb. We were talking about.
Jimmy Webb.
Yeah,
that's right.
Jimmy Webb.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And
the Beatles? Did you ever meet the Beatles?
I did have lunch once with
at Apple. At Apple, yeah, yep.
And it was Andy Williams and his wife Claudine.
Yep.
And who's the guitarist?
George Harrison.
Can you believe that? George Harrison. This is how far down the road I'm getting, I guess. Anyway, George Harrison invited me to have lunch with him at Apple.
That was nice.
He was fascinated by classical gas.
Yep.
So I spent about 3 or 4 hours talking to him about music and whatnot at Apple, and Derek Taylor was there.
Derek Taylor, yeah. I had Peter Asher on the show. He was part of Apple at the time.
Right. I got to know him pretty well, George Harrison, right? And he was also on the Smothers Brothers show.
That's right. That's right.
And I never met Ringo. I never met John Lennon. But I did. Ed Ruscha and I talked to Paul McCartney one time in an airport for about 2 hours. This was in London.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would say I don't know. Steve Martin is about the only person I'm still in touch with that's a star anymore.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of out of the loop.
Well, you'll be back in the loop in 2018 because everybody's going to be happy for the anniversary.
I'm ready to be loopy. If necessary.
Mason, again, thank you so much, man, for being on the show today.
Yeah, all right.
It's been great talking with you, and we'll follow up again. You know.
And I appreciate all the good leading questions. All right.
Sure. I appreciate you. Thank you much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. For more information about Mason Williams, please visit www.masonwilliams. MasonWilliamsOnline.com. It's actually www.masonwilliams. I can never say this word. Hyphen.
Yeah.
Hyphenonline.com.
Somebody already had my name, and I never... It was a
couldn't get rid of that hyphen, huh?
Yeah. A bricklayer on the East Coast had already...
purchase the critically acclaimed A Gift of Song by Mason Williams, an acoustic instrumental Christmas album, available now for the holidays. It's an incredible album. Everybody needs to go out now and put that for your Christmas stocking. Very special thanks to Doug and Don Newsome with VBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly at our new time and date, bi-weekly's Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions, would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, email us, ray@publicityworksagency.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect, in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-8255. 1-888-253-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.